Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the Greek economist Yiannis Varoufakis, who'll update us on the euro crisis. And then at the bottom of the hour, Howie Hawkins, the Green Party's candidate for governor of New York in the recent election, talks about the party and its future. My first guest is Yiannis Varoufakis. Yiannis has been on this show many times to discuss the euro crisis in general and the crisis in his home country, Greece. He was a professor of economics at the University of Athens until the crisis made it difficult for him to do his work. He's now at the University of Texas. At the beginning of the interview, we talked some about the Geithner tapes. These are the transcripts of notes that former Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner dictated to the ghostwriter of his memoirs, though obtained by the Financial Times. They reveal an incredibly dysfunctional euro elite so eager to punish Greece for being an irresponsible debtor that they made the euro crisis far worse than it had to be. The version of events published in the book was far milder than these F-word-laced raw notes, which you can find on the Financial Times website. Yiannis Varoufakis. Were you surprised by the revelation of the Geithner tapes?
In a way, I was. I was surprised that, certainly seasoned politicians like the German finance minister, the Dutch finance minister, would not realize that these conversations are going to see the light of day one day, and they will be judged depending on the phraseology that they used. I was not surprised by the sentiments that they expressed, but it just goes to show what kind of state of mind they were, and it was not a good state.
The frank desire to punish Greece, we kind of got that, but the brutality and frankness of it were shocking.
Indeed, it just goes to show that they had absolutely no concept of what this crisis that they were facing was all about. I mean, they were utterly in the dark. They had assumed, they had allowed themselves to believe that this was a case of, of one rogue failed state that had overborrowed, and it was causing problems for the rest of Europe.
Yeah, I've been thinking for, ever since this crisis broke out, that the European elite was really just not ready for prime time as a ruling class on a significant scale, and this really only confirmed it. They seemed to have no sense of what was going on, no sense of the gravity of the situation, and no sense of what their cheap sadism was going to do to the larger world.
Indeed, and Doug, it's worse. 4.5 years later, they still are clueless. If you look at the conversations that are going on in Brussels and in Frankfurt and in Paris now, this day, as we speak, you'll find that there has been no significant evolution in their thinking. They're still stuck in utterly ridiculous, antiquated views of what went on and what is continuing to go on.
Is there more here than meets the eye? Is this really a cramped worldview and German ordo-liberalism run rampant? Or is there some way that, we've talked about this before, but in what material sense does Germany gain from having put the southern part of Europe through a ringer?
During the last 4 years, Germany has gained significantly. Long term, it's going to be the greatest loser, just like the Allies after the Great War. Having imposed the Versailles Treaty on defeated Germany, in the end, lost more than Germany than Germany did, to some extent. I think that we have a repeat performance of that historical episode. In the last 4 years, in the short term, Germany benefited, and benefited in two important ways. One was that deposits, bank deposits, fled countries like Spain, Ireland, Greece, and ended up in Frankfurt, seeking safety. And that allowed the Frankfurt banks, like Deutsche Bank, like Finanz Bank, to cover up the black holes, the deep, serious insolvency issues that they were facing. Secondly, a great deal of capital flowed into Germany in the form of bonds. German bonds were selling like hotcakes. So to the extent that interest payments were reduced substantially, we've reached a stage where Germany borrows, the German state borrows at 0.8-0.9%. I mean, we haven't had such low yields, low interest rates, since, I believe, the 15th century in Genoa. And that has allowed Germany to reduce its debt to GDP ratio as a result of the crisis. In the first couple of years, 3 years, Germany managed to replace some of the markets that it lost to the imploding European periphery with China. But now that is turning around in not a nice way for Germany. So this is why I'm saying that long term, Germany is going to suffer tremendously.
Well, what have the Germans done with that capital? I mean, that's in a sense the liability side of the balance sheet. What have they done with the capital that's flown in?
Oh, they're exporting it as if there is no tomorrow. And indeed, because they have pushed through austerity, they have pushed the whole of the Eurozone into becoming a greater Germany. I don't know whether you've noticed, but the Eurozone as a whole now has something like $400 billion of a current account surplus. And all that is beginning to be exported to the rest of the world. And Germany ends up owning a lot of dodgy financial assets from the rest of the world.
So this sounds like more problems in the future.
For the global economy. Jack Lew, quite correctly, last November, about a year ago, in the Treasury's report to Congress on the question of currencies and currency manipulation, shifted the emphasis, the focus from China to Germany. And quite correctly said that, if we're worried about currency manipulation, if we're worried about global destabilization, we should be looking to German-driven Eurozone policies that are flooding the world with wave after wave of instability.
Okay, now let's look at the periphery. What's been happening in Greece since we last talked?
Oh, have you heard the news? We are the star performers in terms of growth. We've managed to skyrocket to 0.7%. And we left everybody behind because everybody is at zero territory. So now Greece is the great success story. Now, let's be serious. Everybody talks about the turnaround, how Greece, after an untold number of quarters of shrinkage, has seen the first sign of growth. But you know what? Don't believe it. And when I say don't believe it, I'm not saying that they are lying in terms of numbers. They are lying in terms of the interpretation of the numbers. So take that 0.7% for one quarter, which they then, of course, project to an annual basis, and they've come up with a quite impressive 1.7% growth.
And that's after what sort of decline?
Oh, 26%.
Okay.
But, Doug, it's worse than it sounds. Because, let's say that we have 1.5% growth. Growth of what? Growth of real national income, real GDP. Now, we all know, don't we, that real GDP is a ratio. On the numerator, you place the total euros earned by all Greeks, that's national income in euros, nominal GDP. But then you divide this by an index of prices to capture inflation. Now, it so happens that during the same period, if you look at the official statistics, we had deflation of 2%. So average prices fell by 2%, which means that national income in euros fell. And the only reason why they are celebrating growth is because the decline in nominal income was less than the decline in prices. Now, the problem with Greeks is that they are heavily indebted. Everybody owes to everyone and no one can pay. And the whole nation owes to the rest of the world, as we know, right? The problem is when you're indebted, your real income doesn't matter. What matters is your nominal income. How many euros do you have? Because your debt does not decline when prices fall. Your debt remains in euros. So if you have fewer euros at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether prices have fallen, you still cannot repay your debts. So you become even more insolvent as a result of these developments, which are then portrayed by the international press as Greece having turned the corner.
And, of course, that's nothing further from the truth.
Of course it isn't. If you look at the state of the Greek macroeconomy, it is a complete and utter basket case. I mean, after one-third, one-fourth, one-third whatever, a reduction in the in national income, the only thing that can really pull a nation out of that mire is investment. Now, if you look at fixed capital formation, if you look at statistics on investment, you'll find that there's been no increase in investment. If you look at credit given to small and medium enterprises, it's falling. It's falling as we speak. It's falling by 4 or 5% every quarter. Now, how can you have recovery when you're already in the grapes of wrath territory and there is no investment and no credit? It just can't be done. And it's not being done, but we have a politically inspired attempt to portray Greece as a success story.
So what does this mean for the lives of Greeks?
That it is dusty, brutish, shorter than it used to be, and that they are caught up in a vortex of negative expectations. Greeks being Greeks, of course, they find ways of easing some joy out of this misery. We have a long tradition of doing that. Just look at the opinion polls. You'll find that the governing party, which has had such tremendous support from Berlin, from Frankfurt, from Brussels, even from the United States these days, you know, with all these celebrations of how the government managed to keep Greece together, keep it in the Eurozone, and return it onto the path of growth. Well, this government, this governing party, is languishing at the low 20s in terms of their popularity, 20% of the vote. This is a disastrous performance on their part, given that they have the levers of power and they have complete support of the media in Greece and outside of Greece. And you have the radical left party, Syriza, scoring well above 30% and being poised to win government, or at least to win a plurality of seats such that no government can be formed without Syriza's participation.
I'm speaking with Yanis Varoufakis, who had been a professor of economics at the University of Athens, but the Greek economic crisis drove him to seek refuge at the University of Texas. What would Syriza do if it got in power or close to it?
Well, if you ask me, and you are asking me, so I'll tell you.
Tsipras is not any analogy.
One word sums it up. Negotiate. Negotiate and negotiate. Greece is part of the Eurozone. One thing we could do is to get out of it. We have already discussed this, you and I, many times. It's not an appropriate move, because it's one thing to say you shouldn't have been in there. It's quite another to say you should get out. If you're not going to get out, you have to accept that within the straitjacket of the common currency, there are very few degrees of freedom. There are very few things you can do unilaterally within that straitjacket. So the only thing you can really do is you can negotiate with the rest of Europe. But to negotiate, to be taken seriously, you have to have a credible threat. You have to be prepared to blow the whole thing up simply by being intransigent if you're not taken seriously. So this is my recommendation. Prepare for a very tough, very painful, potentially explosive negotiation.
And then what?
And hope you that the result of the negotiation is a package, not only for Greece, but for the rest of Europe too. Because you can't negotiate for yourself a nice, neat deal while Italy languishes in insolvency, while Ireland remains bogged in these debts on behalf of bankers and so on. Either there is going to be a comprehensive solution which has a different logic to the Austrian logic of the present state of affairs, in which case suddenly all our countries and the Eurozone becomes sustainable again, or my recommendation would be veto everything. Just bring the whole thing to a standstill.
You mentioned Ireland, and that slipped off the radar to some degree. What sort of shape is Ireland in now?
Well, Ireland, if Greece is being portrayed as the success story, imagine how Ireland is celebrated as the country that pulled itself up from the bootstraps and managed to have, you know, significant growth. It is true that GDP growth in Ireland is quite impressive, 4%, 4.5%. But if you look at telltale signs of genuine recovery, you won't find them. You will find that a very large proportion of Irish households remain underwater with negative equity. You'll find that wages have not grown. You'll find that domestic demand is more or less stagnant. You will find that, yes, there has been a slight uptick in employment, but if you add all the hours worked, there hasn't been that much of an increase. So there have been quite a few more, you know, there's been an addition of part-time jobs. And there is this chronic problem with Ireland, the great disparity between gross national products and gross domestic product, because you have all these multinationals like Facebook and so on and so forth, who use Dublin and Cork as their headquarters, only because through various deals with Holland, the Netherlands on the one hand, and some Caribbean islands, they managed to pay just a tiny amount of tax. All those earnings by Facebook and Google and Apple are added to Ireland's GDP, but of course that money never stays in Ireland, doesn't even go through Ireland. So the Irish people don't see it, and their lives are not improved by this circular flow of income.
Well, and yet that Irish situation, you know, there's really it was a branch plant economy with no roots at all to speak of. And, you know, Greece is just certainly no match for German power within the Eurozone. None of these fundamental issues, none of the fundamental contradictions and disparities at the heart of the Euro project, which caused it to blow up, have been resolved. They've only been worsened.
Indeed. They've been made much, much worse. I mean, it is quite remarkable to think that. You know, what was a great problem of the Eurozone? We had this death embrace, as I call it, between very weak banks and insolvent states. That was one of the major structural problems of the Eurozone. Now, what have we done about this? Well, let me tell you what we've done about this. We've made this embrace stronger. We have encouraged these banks to load up on more bonds belonging to the member state, that is, more debt, government debt, while at the same time, the same member state guarantees larger and larger quantities of IOUs issued by the banks. What else have we done? Well, we, in a sense, created a so-called banking union in name, which is denied in substance. We have imposed upon... Take the case of Italy, right? I mean, Italy, even though it is criticized for being the laggard of Europe and so on and so forth. Well, last year, Italy had a very small budget deficit, only 2.9% of GDP. 2.9% of GDP for a recessionary period is actually a very small deficit.
That's about what the U.S. is now.
Yes, indeed. And Italy hasn't grown for, you know, the last 15 years. Its GDP now is much lower than it was in 2008. Even though it doesn't have a large deficit. In fact, it has a primary surplus of 2.4%.
Yiannis here and later on uses the term primary surplus. A country has a primary surplus if its government budget balance is positive, if you exclude interest payments on the debt. In orthodox economic discourse, running a primary surplus is a marvelous virtue.
Nevertheless, its debt is growing, and it will hit within the next 18 months or so, 150% of GDP. Why? Because it is being forced to have large primary surpluses that do one thing. They reduce growth and they feed deflation. And what is the impact of deflation? It makes prices go down while debts remain where they are, and that makes debts worse. And what is the solution that Germany and Brussels is recommending to Italy? A reduction in wages, a reduction in unemployment benefits, further cuts, more what they call structural reforms. Effectively, that means shrinking further aggregate demand, And what is that going to achieve? Supposedly more primary surpluses in order to pay down debt. But in the end, because GDP is going to be squeezed further, even if you repay some of those debts back, the mountain of the debt, when compared to national income, is going to grow and grow and grow until something breaks in this country.
Yes, that's something that's about to break. What is going to break?
It's impossible to know. It's impossible to know. It could be that the political system suddenly throws up some Mussolini, there is a progressive move. Like you can see now in Spain, we have a political party that grew out of the Occupy movement, the Indignados movement, the Indignants movement. They were not around until a few months ago, and now they scored 25% in opinion polls. This is the Podemos party, which is modeled on Syriza in Greece. Already we see that in Ireland, Sinn Féin is leading the polls. In Italy, there is going to be some kind of upheaval. There's absolutely no way that Italy can maintain its current posture when it's being squeezed in this particular manner, further and further down that hole of debt deflationary austerity.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the political response. Why has it taken so long for some kind of political response to what is now getting to be a fairly old crisis?
When things go bad and families lose income, their members lose their jobs, it is a natural, I believe, reaction of people to privatize their concerns and lick their wounds and try to do whatever they can in order to put food on the table. The result is that any radicalism just disappears, and what you have is a wave of pessimism that numbs people and causes them to abandon the public sphere. But that doesn't last forever. And at some point, especially if there is some hope of stabilization, even at very low levels of economic and social activity, something gives, some spark ignites a fire, and especially amongst younger people who just don't believe that they deserve to live in a world that treats them as fodder, one hopes that young people will at some point say enough is enough.
I was Yiannis Varoufakis, who teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Some of the Bourrée from Bach's English Suite No. 1, performed by András Schiff. Next up, Howie Hawkins. Hawkins grew up in Northern California and first became politically active at the age of 12. He moved to Syracuse, New York in 1991 to run a cooperative enterprise that aimed to create an ecologically sustainable economy. For the last 10 years, he's been a truck unloader at UPS at night and a politician by day. As you'll hear, he's run for office many times, but by far his most successful outing was as the Green Party's candidate for governor of New York in the recent election. The incumbent governor, Andrew Cuomo, is a conservative Democrat, the kind who pampers the rich and wants to cut their taxes while promoting fracking and corporate-style education reform. He's also an obnoxious character who has many enemies. The Working Families Party, a largely union-financed organization that nonetheless has an actual grassroots membership, nominated Cuomo over much internal dissent at a convention in May. Many of the members wanted to nominate Zephyr Teachout, a progressive law professor, but the unions, afraid to alienate the Democratic establishment, steamrolled over them. After losing the Working Families Party, Teachout ran in the Democratic primary against Cuomo and got over a third of the votes, much to everyone's surprise. This exposed the fundamental contradiction of the Working Families' whole approach. They were supposed to push the Democrats to the left by endorsing the better ones and challenging the worse ones, but if Cuomo isn't a bad Democrat, I don't know who is. Facing an internal rebellion and a lot of criticism, the party promoted the preposterous line that the best way to punish Cuomo was by voting for him not on the Dem line, but in the Working Families line. As Hawkins will tell us, the Working Families votes enabled Cuomo to squeak out a small majority rather than a mere plurality, which would have embarrassed him nicely. He won re-election, but with a turnout of 30%. His vote count represented the smallest share relative to the state population of any victorious governor in the recent election. How do we break out of this cul-de-sac? Although Howie talks mainly about New York, his argument is relevant across the U.S. Howie Hawkins. Welcome, Howie. So what was the experience of running for governor like? Had you run for office before?
Yeah, I've run 21 times since 1993. I only skipped 1 year to manage another campaign. And I've run lots of local races. City Council in Syracuse started at 3% in 1993 and got up to 48% in 2011. And I've run statewide. I was on the ballot with the Greens as the comptroller candidate, which is totally ignored. But in 2006, I ran against Hillary Clinton. I was the anti-war candidate in that Senate race, and then for governor in 2010, and then again this year in 2014.
Have you seen the Greens grow over time in numbers or scope of appeal?
Well, it's been two steps forward, one step back. We had a big influx with Nader basically standing for election but not spending any money in 96 and then really running in 2000. And then there was the backlash after Florida, and we lost a lot of people. And in New York State, we lost our ballot line for two election cycles. And then we won it back in 2010 and have been building steadily on that. I think the big difference in this election is that unlike when I ran in 06 for, you know, against Clinton and 2010 for governor, this time the local people that were voting for us are saying we want to organize local Green Party chapters. So I think we have a strong basis for, you know, consolidating our organization and creating a real strong base for the future.
One of the things I found disturbing about the Nader candidacies was that there was really, he made no effort to build the Green Party's institution. What do you think the heritage of your really impressive gubernatorial run will do for the Green Party's future?
Well, we're the only party that gained in this election. We basically tripled our vote, quadrupled our percentage. The Democrats lost a million votes. The other parties pretty much maintained. And I think what that does is just psychologically gives people a sense that this is a viable alternative. We do have, you know, a couple mayors and villages upstate and several town board members, so we can win local elections. The next step, I think, for us is to win some city council seats in big cities and maybe a state assembly seat or two. And that, again, creates psychologically that we're not just a protest vote, but we're a legitimate or a competitive option. And I think that brings more people into the effort.
And what sort of operation do you have statewide? Is there some sort of formal structure?
Yeah, we're organized on a county basis, and you have to have a certain level of organization and five dues-paying members. We want our state committee to actually represent organizations, unlike what we had before 2010, after which we rewrote our rules when we got the ballot line. You know, people would just fill out a petition, like in the major parties, to prepare for a primary, but there were hardly ever primaries. So a lot of our state committee members were self-selected without representing an organization. So we're trying to say if you want to have representation on the state level, first you got to organize in your local area. And we divide it up by county, partly because unlike the major parties, which tend to do it by assembly district, we want our local organizations to be engaged in local politics. And outside of New York City, the county is the main institution or government level that, you know, takes state money and runs programs and does the economic development policy and so forth. So we want our organizations organized at that level so we can seriously engage in local politics, which is the foundation for being able to really compete for state assembly, state senate seats.
And what do you have going in New York City? That's a big note to crack.
Well, we've got a pretty strong organization in Brooklyn and another group in Manhattan. Other than that, it's been scattered. But coming out of this election, we got a strong group in the Bronx around Ramon Jimenez, who was our attorney general candidate. They want to organize. Manhattan has really increased. Our vote totals, particularly in Manhattan and Brooklyn, went up by eight or so times our previous vote. So there's a basis, I think, to build on this election. And, you know, in all the areas, people want to organize their boroughs. And then we haven't had a strong citywide coordination, but we were talking this weekend about how to get that organized. And, you know, the question was, do we need a strong center or should we encourage local organizing? And the conclusion was we need a strong center to support the local organizing. So I think in New York City there'll be some kind of citywide organization to help everybody. And then statewide thing. I mean, our goal now is to build up the dues-paying membership so we can support staff people to support our organizing.
And, of course, you benefited greatly from the fact that Andrew Cuomo is widely hated and the Working Families Party made an enormous mistake by endorsing him. Can you make inroads against Democrats if there's not somebody as odious as Cuomo at the head of the ticket?
Well, no doubt the conservative policies of Cuomo pushed a lot of people to us. And looking at our vote totals, you know, our conclusion is about half of our nearly 200,000 votes were people that are now for an independent left, and half were people who were Democrats, mainly who just couldn't stand Cuomo and voted for us as a protest vote. We had half a dozen progressive or liberal Democratic clubs in the city endorse us. It's a first for all of them. We had half a dozen teachers' locals endorse us, even though the state federation said we're neutral. The locals went ahead in defiance and endorsed us. I don't think those organizations have broken with the Democratic Party, but I think they see us as an option at times in elections and also people we can work with on issues that are up before the state legislature this year that we were running on during the campaign. And then, you know, the other 100,000 that, you know, I think are voting for a new direction in politics are the people that we've got to try to get more involved in the Green Party.
And what did, if anything, did the Teach Out campaign contribute to your total?
Well, it doesn't look like they did much. I mean, they got in a 9% participation primary about 200,000 votes, and that's what we got in the general election. And we, you know, heard a lot from people that said Teach Out in the primary, Hawkins in the general. But when you look at the numbers, it doesn't look like many of those votes came to us. I mean, there was a big effort by Working Families Party to protest Cuomo's agenda by voting for Cuomo on their line, which seems absurd.
Because it is absurd, yes.
Yeah. In the end, that vote was enough to give Cuomo a majority rather than a plurality mandate. And it was enough. If they had come to us, we would have passed the conservatives to be the fourth line, a third line on the ballot instead of the fourth. The conservatives actually gained a little bit in this election, and given the lower turnout, they went from, what, 232,000 to 239,000, and we're, you know, down at 200,000. So that protest vote of Cuomo really helped the right, I think. You know, Cuomo as the center right and the conservatives as the far right.
And there's been a perception in the past, true or not, that the Greens had historically been a party that appealed to a professional managerial class. First of all, is that true? And have you really moved away from that to a broader, more working class base?
Yeah, both of those things are true. I mean, you look around the world, the first Greens, you know, that got involved were, they tended to be from the, you know, middle class in the helping professions, you know, teachers, social workers, professors. And for a long time, that was our base. But over time, because we've been hitting on economic justice issues, like raising the minimum wage to a living wage, and single-payer health care, and a public jobs program for the unemployed. I can see this in Syracuse. You know, our strength started around Syracuse University, the East Side neighborhood, but over the years, our strength has grown in the blue-collar neighborhoods. This is a very poor city. I mean, the overall poverty rate is 38%, child poverty rate is 55%, the median income is $25,000, and our vote has grown in the working-class neighborhoods. And when there's a close election where the lesser evil question, the spoiler question comes up, we tend to lose votes in the university neighborhood, whereas in the blue-collar neighborhoods, people like say, you know, these people are on our side, we're voting for them. So I think what we've seen in Syracuse can spread across the state. I haven't been able to do, you know, election district analysis of where our vote came from in this election. It's just not out yet, but it will be in a couple of weeks, and we'll see. But I think that's where the Greens are going to grow if we're going to be a serious contender. The people that really won this election were the non-voters, and those tend to be the hourly workers or the people that want hourly jobs. There are 6 million of them that aren't voting, and another million joined them by who had voted for Cuomo in 2010 and didn't vote this time. They stayed home. So 70% of New Yorkers aren't voting. And my perception from doing petitioning and knocking on doors is these people are totally disgusted with both parties. They think the politicians have no idea what their lives are like, don't care about them, and are going to do what they're going to do no matter who we vote for. So they've just dropped out to the point where some of them aren't even following the news. They just, it's like the weather. You can't do anything about it, so why get upset? And what we've got to do as Greens is become, you know, a presence in communities where, you know, we build relationships, are trusted, and then people can see, and then do well in elections well enough that they can see some hope. And I think that's what's missing. People feel powerless and hopeless.
You spoke some about this already, but what did you campaign on? What kinds of issues and what did and didn't work in your experience?
Well, we called for a Green New Deal for New York, and it was basically the economic human rights that have been on the agenda since the 30s with the New Deal, the right to a job, a living wage, affordable housing, health care, and a good education, plus 100% green energy in the next 15 years, which addresses climate crisis, but also is a full employment program. We cited this study by Cornell and Stanford researchers that says if New York committed to that 100% clean energy in 15 years, it would create 4.5 million jobs in manufacturing and construction mainly, which are good middle-income jobs, and it would cut electric rates in half. So it's a big economic benefit as well as a environmental program. And so that was the way we presented it. And then to the question of how do you pay for it, we said go back to the more progressive tax structure we had in the 1970s. If we did that in New York, 95% of New Yorkers would get a tax cut. State revenues would go up 20%. We could restore revenue sharing to 8% of the state budget instead of it's less than 1% now. And then we could lower the property taxes, which are the highest in the nation, and also fully fund our schools and services. And the school issue was huge. I mean, I think that's why we got so many education advocate organizations as well as teachers unions supporting us, because we're at a 65-year low in terms of state aid to public education as a proportion of the state budget. And it's been devastating, particularly upstate. I mean, in my city, we've lost a quarter of our staff in the schools since the Great Recession. And in both the inner city upstate schools and the rural schools, they're on the verge of insolvency, and they're cutting programs and cutting teachers. And Cuomo is, you know, in the closing days of the election, he said, break the only remaining public monopoly, referring to the schools and the teachers' unions, and also said that the way we're going to cut property taxes is by local government cutting their spending, which means those are going to be two huge issues going forward. And they really resonated in this campaign, and I think can continue speaking to them and building support.
I'm speaking with the former gubernatorial candidate in New York, Howie Hawkins, who ran on the Green Party ticket and got more votes than any Green in the history of the state. Yeah, you're talking about a Green New Deal, and addressing the climate issue could also be a jobs program. Historically, a lot of people have seen environmental politics as elitist and really has nothing to say to the working class. You, of course, disagree strongly with that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look at the Bronx and East Harlem, the highest asthma rates in the country. And actually, last night at Hostos Community College, there was hearings about this fresh direct $132 million subsidy for them to expand their trucking facility there. 1,000 trucks spewing out diesel fuel, and they're paying people $10 an hour. So there you got environmental justice, living wage, climate. I mean, all our issues are right there, and so that's something Greens are going to be involved in. And that, you know, the pollution tends to be worse in the working class communities. So, and then the jobs versus environment thing is baloney. I mean, fracking, which the oil and gas industry is pushing in New York, can't create a fraction of the jobs that we can by going to clean energy.
We just passed an election where the Democrats nationally got their asses handed to them. What's your analysis of what happened a few Tuesdays ago?
Well, the Democrats are caught between their voting base, which tends to be, you know, working and middle class, and their funders, which is the 1%, really the 1/100th of 1%. And they went for the money. And I think they're going to continue going for the money, and they're going to keep losing their voting base, which, you know, is where the Greens have got to go and speak to those people. But what we got to do is form a different kind of funding base. You know, they're funded by the 1%. We got to be funded by the 99%. In other words, we got to do a membership party where if you're a member of the party, you contribute according to your ability. And that's what left-wing parties around the world have done to create popular parties to challenge, you know, the power of big capital. And in this country, that project has been stillborn. The Socialist Party in the early part of the century, you know, was really moving that way and were very critical of the old party structures. And I happened to run into, just post-election, I was looking for some numbers, and there was a state legislative committee report. The Socialists elected six state assembly members there during World War I, and they weren't seated. And then the assembly came out with this justification. It's a 1,500-page document on the Socialist movement around the world, and you look at what they say about the Socialist Party of America and in New York, and they say it's not really a party, it's a membership organization. It's funded by their own members, which just made me laugh.
Isn't that what a party is supposed to be?
Yeah, well, that's what they are everywhere else in the world. But here, they're top-down, and you get message from the top, the money comes from the top, the top pre-selects. It's like Boss Tweed in a different way. Boss Tweed used to say, you can vote for anybody you want as long as I get to pick the candidates. So the funders pre-select who gets offered to us, and then we get to choose between who's going to rule us. So if we're going to have an alternative to that, you know, the people have got to fund it like we do our unions. You know, everybody pays dues. They have lots of resources. So we need to do the same thing for an alternative political party.
And, of course, every time you bring up Greens or any other third-party attempt, people will often say, oh, but you're just going to give elections to the Republicans. It's the lesser evil. It's the best we can do. What about the Supreme Court? What's your response to that line?
Well, I think mainly when the Greens are in the races, we expand the electorate for the most part. So like I was talking earlier, in this race, Cuomo was so bad, we did get protest votes that normally would have been Democratic. But, you know, there are at least 100,000 votes out of that 200,000 that probably wouldn't have voted if we weren't on the ballot. So I think that's the way I look at it. And also, if you just keep voting for the lesser evil, the dynamic of politics is to the right. And, you know, we've had 40 years now where the Democrats have abandoned their New Deal demands. They're not for national health insurance. They're not for a public jobs program for the unemployed. They're not for a minimum wage that you can live on. They've just dropped those demands, you know, and to the extent they're more liberal, it's on some social issues. But they're so conservative economically, I don't even give them credit for being socially progressive. So there's a huge vacuum there, and I think that's what the Greens will fill.
What did you learn from this election that you'll carry forward?
We need to pay less attention to the liberal Democrats. You know, the Teach Out got a lot of attention, and the liberal media, you know, really focused on her. And I think a lot of Greens were thinking, oh, we can get those people to vote for us. And there was a strong effort made, and they knew we were out there, but a lot of them didn't come to us. And then you look at 7 million people that didn't vote, who are mostly working class people, who the political system does not represent. And I think that's, to me, you know, where we've got to focus in terms of going forward.
And your longer-term strategy is that?
Consolidate what we can from this campaign organizationally and build our base, and then have an organizing strategy where we're an ongoing presence in our communities, where we're active on the issues between as well as during elections. And then, you know, pick races where we can be competitive and run serious campaigns so we're credible, and just build from the bottom up like that. And, you know, one thing about movements is they don't go incrementally. They tend to, you know, plateau and then jump up in steps. And, you know, I've seen that going back to the anti-Vietnam War movement, anti-nuclear movement, anti-apartheid movement, global justice movement against those trade agreements. You know, I was in movements where we were in the minority and felt like we were getting nowhere, and suddenly it flipped and we were in the majority. The people were with us. And I think at some point we're going to see that in electoral politics, because, you know, a lot of people, they like what the Greens say, but they say, nothing's going to change. Nobody's going to vote for you. You're just too small. And at some point, everybody's going to jump, just like in these other movements. It's like a chicken and egg problem. And at some point, either the chicken or the egg is going to be there, and then we're going to get going.
And a lot of people just focus so obsessively on presidential politics. The Nader runs were, in some sense, like some sort of attempt at a magical intervention from above to transform the political system. It sounds like you're really trying to build local and state power as a first priority.
Yeah, and the Greens have really had that perspective since we started in the 80s. I mean, from my point of view, I got involved with the Peace and Freedom Party in 1967, 68. And then there was the People's Party with Ben Spock and the Citizens Party with, Barry Commoner. And they tried to build from a presidential campaign down. And so Greens decided we'd do it locally. Nader being willing to run, I can't think of anybody in his generation at that time who could have run a credible presidential campaign that got some attention. So we went with it. And now I think we have to run candidates just to show the flag and support local organizing. But the emphasis has got to be on building, local organizations and getting people into local office and showing that we're credible and can do a good job and can win elections. And you can build from there. And you got to have a grassroots base, or the presidential thing, it's so much fought through, big dollars in the media, billions of dollars, that, we can't compete on that without a organized grassroots base.
And what kind of relations do you have with Green parties around the country?
Well, it's very loose. Each state is pretty much autonomous. There is a national organization, but it really comes together at times just for the presidential elections. And there's, a small media operation and some fundraising to keep, a couple people on staff. But the Greens decided at the time of the Nader campaigns to have a weak center and try to emphasize the state organizing. My opinion is we need a strong center to support that organizing. So we've got to, balance that. But that's where we're at this point. It's a weak center, and people are expected to take initiative in their states. And it takes a while to learn how to organize. And I think the Greens also, as they developed, they thought we're a new politics, so we have nothing to learn from what went before us, but actually we do. And I think over the years, the Greens have, begun to realize that.
And do people still bring up the 2000 election and Ralph Nader giving it all to Bush, or is that fading from memory?
Yeah, it still comes up, particularly from middle-class Democrats. They're the ones that are obsessed. I mean, just to take Syracuse, when I was petitioning for Nader in 04 and 08, you go up around the university neighborhood and it's hostile. Oh, you guys caused Bush in the war and blah, blah, blah. You go into blue-collar neighborhoods, yeah, Ralph Nader's for the people. I'll sign that petition. And that, I think, is still, where we mostly have the problem with the people that, I think they overthink politics. Like this vote for Cuomo, to protest Cuomo, it just doesn't make any sense, but people rationalize it. And it tends to be the more professional managerial types.
Well, it sounds like the professional managerial liberal Democrats are hopeless and should stop trying to win many converts among them.
Well, I think there are sectors of people, who have salaries, have some autonomy. They're middle class. Teachers come to mind right away. Their situation with this high stakes testing aligned to Common Core and the job insecurity now. And, the attacks by the Democrats, between the Obama administration and Arne Duncan and Cuomo and John King here in New York State, they're under attack and their job is being degraded. And so they're being alienated, turned more into workers than middle class people. And I think there are sectors of the salaried middle class that don't have job security and are beginning to realize they're being pushed into the working class. So I think there's still sectors there that we can reach and appeal to. And so I wouldn't write them off, but I think the biggest, votes that we could get are the working class people, the hourly workers who have just given up on politics because they just feel nobody up there cares about them.
So what's next for you?
Well, I'm going to be traveling around the state like I did this weekend when I'm not at work, working with county organizations, helping them get better organized. And then we're going to be focused on some of the state legislative issues coming up that we spoke to in the campaign. It's going to be a big fight around school funding, and Cuomo promised another round of teacher evaluations based on high-stakes testing, so there'll be that fight. The state budget is an austerity budget. I mean, one of my biggest disappointments is we never got that debated in this campaign. It was a big issue in 2010. He's already said to his budget director, already told the agencies, don't ask for an increase. And he's telling the local governments, we're going to lower property taxes by you lowering your spending. So you know, these are issues we want to speak to, and I'll be involved in that. So we hope to maintain our presence in the media. That was a big change in this election. I mean, we were taken a lot more seriously. I think it's once we got above 5% in the polls that they began to realize they better cover us because we're part of the what's going on in this election. So we want to hope to maintain that presence and communicate to a broader public that way.
That was Howie Hawkins, who ran for governor of New York on the Green Party ticket. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Eels Sang by Wire from last year's album Change Becomes Us. Till next week, bye.
Her brother's side of spin, Koresh was his designer, may my strength be something like a Heidi Nail and Eels Sang.